as director of the CIA, Teddy Maynard, had been to the White House less than 10 times. And never for dinner. He always declined for health reasons. And never to say howdy to a foreign hotshot. He couldn't have cared less. Back when he could walk, he had occasionally stopped by to confer with whoever happened to be president, and perhaps one or two of his policymakers. Now, since he was in a wheelchair, his conversations with the White House were by phone. Twice, a vice president had actually been driven out to Langley to meet with Mr. Maynard. The only advantage of being in a wheelchair was that it provided a wonderful excuse to go or stay or do whatever he damn well pleased. No one wanted to push around an old, crippled man. A spy for almost 50 years, he now preferred the luxury of looking directly behind himself when he moved about. He traveled in an unmarked white van, bulletproof glass, lead walls, 2 heavily armed boys perched behind the heavily armed driver, with his wheelchair clamped to the floor in the rear and facing back, so that Teddy could see the traffic that could not see him. 2 other vans followed at a distance, and any misguided attempt to get near the director would be instantly terminated. None was expected. Most of the world thought Teddy Maynard was either dead or idling away his final days in some secret nursing home where old spies were sent to die. Teddy wanted it that way. He was wrapped in a heavy gray quilt and tended to by Hobie, his faithful aide. As the van moved along the beltway at a constant 60 miles an hour, Teddy sipped green tea poured from a thermos by Hobie and watched the cars behind them. Hobie sat next to the wheelchair on a leather stool made especially for him. A sip of tea and Teddy said,
"Where's Backman right now?"
"In his cell," Hobie answered.
"And our people are with the warden?"
"They're sitting in his office waiting." Another sip from a paper cup, one carefully guarded with both hands. The hands were frail, veiny, the color of skim milk, as if they had already died and were patiently waiting for the rest of the body.
"How long will it take to get him out of the country?"
"About 4 hours."
"And the plan is in place?"
"Everything is ready. We're waiting on the green light."
"I hope this moron can see it my way."
Kritz and the moron were staring at the walls of the Oval Office, their heavy silence broken occasionally by a comment about Joel Backman. They had to talk about something because neither would mention what was really on his mind. Can this be happening? Is this finally the end? 40 years, from Cornell to the Oval Office. The end was so abrupt that they had not had enough time to properly prepare for it. They had been counting on 4 more years. 4 years of glory as they carefully crafted a legacy, then rode gallantly into the sunset. Though it was late, it seemed to grow even darker outside. The windows that overlooked the Rose Garden were black. A clock above the fireplace could almost be heard as it ticked nonstop in its final countdown.
"What will the press do if I pardon Backman?" the president asked, not for the first time. "Go berserk."
"That might be fun."
"You won't be around."
"No, I won't."
After the transfer of power at noon the next day, his escape from Washington would begin with a private jet owned by an oil company to an old friend's villa on the island of Barbados. At Morgan's instructions, the televisions had been removed from the villa, no newspapers or magazines would be delivered, and all phones had been unplugged. He would have no contact with anyone, not even Kritz, and especially not Mrs. Morgan, for at least a month. He wouldn't care if Washington burned. In fact, he secretly hoped that it would. After Barbados, he would sneak up to his cabin in Alaska, and there he would continue to ignore the world as the winter passed and he waited on spring.
"Should we pardon him?" the president asked.
"Probably," Kritz said. The president had shifted to the we mode now, something he invariably did when a potentially unpopular decision was at hand. For the easy ones, it was always I. When he needed a crutch, and especially when he would need someone to blame, he opened up the decision-making process and included Kritz. Kritz had been taking the blame for 40 years, and though he was certainly used to it, he was nonetheless tired of it. He said, "There's a very good chance we wouldn't be here had it not been for Joel Backman." "You may be right about that," the president said. He had always maintained that he had been elected because of his brilliant campaigning, charismatic personality, uncanny grasp of the issues, and clear vision for America. To finally admit that he owed anything to Joel Backman was almost shocking. But Kritz was too calloused and too tired to be shocked. 6 years ago, the Backman scandal had engulfed much of Washington and eventually tainted the White House. A cloud appeared over a popular president, paving the way for Arthur Morgan to stumble his way into the White House. Now that he was stumbling out, he relished the idea of one last arbitrary slap in the face to the Washington establishment that had shunned him for 4 years. A reprieve for Joel Backman would rattle the walls of every office building in D.C. and shock the press into a blathering frenzy. Morgan liked the idea. While he sunned away on Barbados, the city would gridlock once again as congressmen demanded hearings and prosecutors performed for the cameras and the insufferable talking heads prattled nonstop on cable news. The president smiled into the darkness. On the Arlington Memorial Bridge over the Potomac River, Hobie refilled the director's paper cup with green tea.
"Thank you," Teddy said softly. "What's our boy doing tomorrow when he leaves office?" he asked.
"Fleeing the country."
"He should have left sooner."
"He plans to spend a month in the Caribbean licking his wounds, ignoring the world, pouting, waiting for someone to show some interest."
"And Mrs. Morgan?"
"She's already back in Delaware playing bridge."
"Are they splitting?"
"If he's smart, who knows?" Teddy took a careful sip of tea.
"So what's our leverage if Morgan balks?"
"I don't think he'll balk. The preliminary talks have gone well. Kritz seems to be on board. He has a much better feel of things now than Morgan. Kritz knows that they would have never seen the Oval Office had it not been for the Backman scandal."
"As I said, what's our leverage if he balks?"
"None, really. He's an idiot, but he's a clean one." They turned off Constitution Avenue onto 18th Street and were soon entering the east gate of the White House. Men with machine guns materialized from the darkness. Then Secret Service agents in black trench coats stopped the van. Code words were used. Radios squawked. And within minutes, Teddy was being lowered from the van. Inside, a cursory search of his wheelchair revealed nothing but a crippled and bundled up old man. Artie, minus the Heineken, and again without knocking, poked his head through the door and announced, "Maynard's here."
"So he's alive," the president said.
"Barely."
"Then roll him in."
Hobie and a deputy named Pretty followed the wheelchair into the Oval Office. The president and Kritz welcomed their guests and directed them to the sitting area in front of the fireplace. Though Maynard avoided the White House, Pretty practically lived there, briefing the president every morning on intelligence matters. As they settled in, Teddy glanced around the room as if looking for bugs and listening devices. He was almost certain there were none. That practice had ended with Watergate. Nixon laid enough wire in the White House to juice a small city, but of course, he paid for it. Teddy, however, was wired. Carefully hidden above the axle of his wheelchair, just inches below his seat, was a powerful recorder that would capture every sound made during the next 30 minutes. He tried to smile at President Morgan, but he wanted to say something like, "You are without a doubt the most limited politician I have ever encountered. Only in America could a moron like you make it to the top." President Morgan smiled at Teddy Maynard, but he wanted to say something like, "I should have fired you 4 years ago. Your agency has been a constant embarrassment to this country." "Teddy, I was shocked when you carried a single state, albeit by 17 votes." "Morgan, you could